In a presentation for the Gallatin Valley Friends of the Sciences, Dr. Lance McNew, MSU Associate Professor of Wildlife Habitat Ecology, discusses how working rangelands can be managed to preserve grouse, songbirds, and other range-dependent wildlife. The series is co-sponsored by the Museum of the Rockies and Hopa Mountain, recorded at the Museum of the Rockies on November 16, 2022.
Dr. Lance McNew is MSU Associate Professor of Wildlife Habitat Ecology. He holds a PhD in ecology from Kansas State University. His research focuses on evaluating interactions of habitat management, including fire and livestock grazing, and unmanaged environmental conditions on grassland-associated wildlife. He's worked in a variety of grassland, shrubland, and forested ecosystems throughout the western U.S., and is editor of a new textbook, Rangeland Wildlife Ecology and Conservation, to be published next year.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you tonight about how important functional rangeland ecosystems are to wildlife in North America and the world more broadly, and to tell you a little bit about the type of research that we do in the Wildlife Habitat Ecology Lab, trying to understand how ecosystem functioning in rangelands affects wildlife communities and also how wildlife communities advance ecosystem functioning in rangeland systems. But before we get started, I have to ask this question, because I'm still trying to figure it out myself. What is a rangeland? We need to talk about that first, I think. So when you picture a rangeland, many of you probably envision something like this. At least I do. And you're not wrong. Or you might envision some charismatic species mixed in, or perhaps some charismatic people. Unfortunately, or I guess I should say confusingly, it's been relatively hard to find a solid definition of what a rangeland is, because it encompasses so many different types of vegetative biomes and ecosystems. The USDA NRCS probably has the most accepted definition, and they define a rangeland as a land on which the indigenous vegetation is predominantly grass-like, plants, forbs, and dispersed trees. So areas dominated by herbaceous vegetation. But importantly, the second bullet here indicates that these areas are managed through ecosystem processes rather than agronomic applications. So agronomic application are things like, you know, planting, disking, plowing, harvesting, cutting trees, and so on and so forth, whereas ecological processes are things that historically occurred naturally, such as fire and grazing by large herbivores and even small herbivores like locusts. So rangelands worldwide are characterized by low and variable precipitation, nutrient-poor soils, high spatial and temporal variability in plant production. And this, of course, resulted, we can thank those effects as the reason why we currently have rangelands. So in essence, rangelands are lands that were left over after highly productive sites were, quote unquote, improved for human settlement in North America 150 years ago. Rangelands also include, by this definition, shrublands such as our sage steppe, savannas and parklands, even deserts are rangelands, as are wetlands, some woodlands, depending on the composition of trees versus herbaceous vegetation, can be classified as rangelands, and even Arctic and Alpine tundra are rangeland ecosystems. So that makes rangelands, collectively, the most prevalent land type on the ice-free Earth, all right, and water-free Earth. Roughly 50% of the world's land surface can be considered rangelands. And it's certainly the most prevalent land type that we have in the western United States, here indicated by this yellow color, but also these red or maroon colors and the purple areas represent transitional type of rangeland ecosystems that we have. That's in the conterminous U.S., about 761 million acres of the land surface in the U.S., and roughly half of that is publicly owned and the other half is privately owned. Unfortunately, rangelands, especially temperate grasslands and shrubland ecosystems, have and continue to be lost at a rate that far outpaces any other vegetative biome on the planet. No doubt you're familiar with the rapid depletion of the world's rainforests. Well, losses of temperate grasslands and shrublands far outpace the loss of tropical rainforests globally. Most of the world's grasslands and shrublands have already been lost, and much of the loss has occurred right here in our backyard in North America. So in the Great Plains, represented here on this map, we've already lost 95% of our tall grass prairie ecosystems, which historically occurred in the eastern portions of the Great Plains and in the Midwest. We've lost roughly 3/4 of our mixed grass prairie ecosystems, which occurred in the northern portions of the Great Plains and also the southern portion of the Great Plains. And we've lost roughly half of our short grass prairie ecosystems in the more arid western portions of the Great Plains. And the hemorrhaging isn't over. We're still losing between 1 and 5% annually of our native grasslands and shrubland ecosystems. That's almost, well, it exceeds in some years, 1 million acres per year in North America are still being lost, primarily due to cultivation. And here's a map from the World Wildlife Foundation that illustrates this point. And you can keep track on this on their website, Plowprint, to see what ongoing losses are. On more arid rangelands, in the western United States, the primary threat is tree encroachment. In fact, and that's represented here by these green colors, there's widespread and rampant tree encroachment across almost every rangeland ecosystem in the western United States. In fact, there's not a single type of rangeland system in the western United States that's not being affected by tree encroachment. All right, and this is primarily due to the elimination of a key ecosystem process in rangelands, fire. So why should we care? Why should we care? Well, given that you're in this room, I think you probably already do. But here's why I think you should care. So rangelands provide a host, a wide variety, and a lot of different types of both social cultural services and ecological or ecosystem services. So certainly we're familiar with the social cultural values that rangelands provide, being that we're all living in an agricultural state. More than 100 million head of livestock are raised on rangelands in the U.S. annually, and that provides significant economic impact to most of the western United States. It provides a lot of open space type recreation from bird watchers and hunters and hikers and a number of other types of recreation. It also provides this, which we don't think about too much, a really important service that rangelands provide is a sense of place. So indigenous peoples have lived on the rangelands of North America for tens of thousands of years, and their identities are culturally linked to those landscapes, as are the ranchers whose families have been here for 150 years. They also have a similar sense of identity. I'm an ecologist, so I think about more along the lines of ecosystem services, and they do a lot of that as well. They provide clean water, and they regulate hydrology. Rangelands are a giant carbon sink, even when livestock are grazed upon them. They provide a wide variety of diversity of both wildlife and other types of critters. I guess everything is wildlife, really, that I'm thinking of, insects, other invertebrates. Overall, massive amounts of ecological servicing that rangelands are providing for us. But I'm a wildlife ecologist, so the ecosystem service that I'm most interested in is how rangelands provide wildlife habitat, and they do that considerably. Rangelands in the western U.S., we don't have a good handle on this number. We're currently trying to work that out, actually, in my lab. Provide habitat at some part of the life stage for more than 2,000, maybe upwards of 3,000 different species of vertebrates and innumerable species of invertebrates. By comparison, I just wanted to point out here that Yellowstone National Park, our oldest and highly diverse national park, provides habitat for 394 vertebrate species. Rangelands collectively in the western U.S. provide habitat for almost 10 times the number of species that we have in Yellowstone. That's certainly not to downplay the importance of Yellowstone. All right. Unfortunately, the majority of rangeland-associated wildlife are in decline. And the poster child of these wildlife losses are grassland and shrub-associated birds. So grass and birds, as you can see from this green line, have shown rapid declines and significant and sustained declines since we've been surveying them since the 1960s. In contrast, other species of birds have collectively stabilized, or in the case of wetland birds, due to large-scale investment in the conservation of wetlands, we've seen that they've actually improved over the last several decades. The primary cause, of course, of the losses is the widespread breakout and loss of grassland and shrubland habitats to cultivation, no doubt. But we're still seeing declines of grassland-associated wildlife, specifically grassland birds, in areas that are relatively intact. So the question, obviously, is why is that? So please, someone tell me why. Why are we still seeing declines and significant declines in grassland obligate birds and other grassland-associated wildlife in our intact prairie systems, even in Montana? Humans, habitat, I'm hearing a lot of right answers. I heard grazing. So how many of you think livestock grazing is bad for grassland birds? How many think livestock grazing is good for grassland birds? How many don't know? Congratulations, every one of you is correct. And especially the ones that were shrugging, I don't really know, because the answer is complicated. All right, so grazing by large herbivores, including livestock, can have positive effects on rangeland ecosystems. It can promote ecological functioning, it can improve rangeland condition, it can certainly improve primary productivity above ground. So many of you are probably familiar or heard about the recent research showing how bison create this thing called a green wave for other herbivores. Livestock producers have known about that for 100 years. So cattle do the same thing. But most importantly, the widespread grazing distribution of large herbivore grazing for financial profit, in my mind, has resulted in a market-based system of grassland conservation. So these are areas, as I mentioned, that were left over from cultivation. Most of these rangelands we're going to talk about tonight evolved under some level of disturbance, either by fire or grazing, or actually both. And without some sort of a surrogate for that disturbance, a lot of them would be turned into woodlands. All right, so we can thank livestock grazing at least for preserving or intact the continuity of rangelands, at least in the Great Plains. That's not true everywhere. However, improper livestock grazing management can have the opposite effect, for sure. So we see negative effects reported for plant biodiversity, invertebrate biodiversity. We see negative effects on plant species by biomass. Also residual cover, which is critical for a lot of these grassland birds. And then finally, persistent improper grazing by wildlife results in long-term range decline. All right, which is no good for anything, production, agriculture, or wildlife. Grazing-wildlife interactions as a result of this have been a major focus of research for the last 20 to 30 years. And most of this research is focused on evaluating the indirect effects of livestock grazing on wildlife. So the effects that happen on wildlife habitat through the alteration of vegetation communities and the structure of the habitat, rather than like direct effects of like trampling or eating birds or something. Grazing, as a result of these studies, is often cited to explain changes in the distribution, abundance, and demography of wildlife. There's been hundreds of papers. Here are just a few that we've produced in our lab demonstrating this. However, the effects of livestock grazing on even a single species can vary across studies, making broad applicability of results to rangeland management unclear. And here's an example of that. Take, for example, this most charismatic species of rangelands, the grasshopper sparrow. This bird is an indicator species for intact grassland habitats. It's endemic to the Great Plains of North America, and it occurs over a variety of different grassland-type ecosystems. It's been studied as a result many times. Several studies have shown actually there's a positive effect of quote-unquote livestock grazing on the abundance or breeding densities or, in some cases, nest survival for this species. Other studies In other portions of the Great Plains have shown that there's no effect of livestock grazing relative to some unknown control, which sometimes they report and sometimes they don't, unfortunately. And then yet other studies have more subtle findings showing that, well, it depends on the type of livestock grazing that happens, with sometimes livestock grazing being good and on other times livestock grazing being bad for this particular species. So clearly, rangeland management recommendations to benefit grasshopper sparrows from these studies are inconsistent at best. So if I'm a what's a conservation-minded land manager to do when they see all of this conflicting literature reported in the peer-reviewed science? The answer is complicated, but it can be boiled down to this. The positive or the negative effects of grazing on grass and associated wildlife species are dependent on, first of all, one, how the study was designed, which varies markedly across studies. We need to standardize that if we can. And two, the local environmental conditions and how grazing management matches the historical ecosystem processes that occurred at a site where grazing is applied. So let's talk briefly about the historical ecological process that shape rangelands and associated wildlife. So historically, and much of what I'm going to be talking about henceforth is only appropriate or is limited in scope to rangelands that are east of here in the Great Plains. So historically, two major ecological processes shaped the creation and maintenance of most rangeland ecosystems, and those were fire and grazing by large herbivores. Fire was set either naturally or by indigenous peoples for a variety of reasons, and the coupling of fire with livestock grazing created, first of all, the extent of grasslands that we have in North America and maintain those, but also the structural complexity or heterogeneity that we see or saw in the Great Plains. So these two ecological processes are coupled due to the fact that fire removes residual vegetation and creates a plethora of high quality and highly available forage for large herbivores. So the herbivores follow fire around the landscape. So you can imagine that historically, a naturally set fire, a spatially variable, temporally variably set fire by indigenous peoples would create this shifting mosaic of different disturbances across the landscape. So here's my poor attempt to cartoon this. Apologies, but this is historically what we have, is a system that's like this in the Great Plains, where you'd have a fire set. The bison are like, yum, 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 here's all the good grass, it's nothing in the way, I can graze all of it, and they'd follow that around at scales that were millions of acres, unimpeded by a fence. All right, and over time, as the fire moved around, you'd get this variability, or what we like to call heterogeneity, at multiple spatial scales and vegetation composition and structure. Most modern rangeland management practices were developed to increase livestock production by one, first of all, promoting the dominance of a few key forage species, and managing grazing distribution and stocking rates to homogenize the livestock uses of grasses. That is, production-focused rangeland management attempts to reduce the inherent landscape heterogeneity or variability that naturally occurs due to all this variability in topo and edaphic conditions, and also the fact that large herbivores are very selective grazers. That naturally creates heterogeneity. Modern rangeland management is designed to try to homogenize that away. Before we go start picking on range scientists, we should recognize that these systems were based on a foundation of experiments related to how plants respond to persistent defoliation. So rangeland managers discovered long, long time ago that as grazing pressure increases, root mass, and therefore the viability of herbaceous plants in the Great Plains, decreases. And that this decrease is nonlinear. And here's a bunch grass species. You can see the root mass dense, it's viable, it's healthy. Defoliation up to persistent defoliation over and over and over again, up to 50% of the biomass, reduces a little bit of the root mass, but not enough to affect above ground primary production. But once you exceed 50% utilization of the above ground forage, you start seeing rapid depletion of the root mass and degradation of those grass plants. All right, so early rangeland management for livestock production said, hey, we should try to keep grazing or defoliation somewhere below 50% so we maintain our crop of forage moving into the future. And we should do that as evenly as possible using systems that are designed to homogenize the distribution of livestock across our management units or landscapes. All right, so that manage to the middle, or often what is, since it's 50%, what's often called the take half, leave half approach, that is kind of disconnected to what actually occurred through that those normal historical ecological processes that created this gradient of disturbances based on livestock grazing intensity over time and space. So naturally, we see that there's a lot of variability in historical systems that drove or provided habitat to very specialized critters. And this is just grassland birds because I like grassland birds, sorry. But it's true for a lot of other species as well. So we see that the niche spaces or selection spaces for these different grass and obligate species, they evolved to fill niches associated with these gradients and disturbances. And if we're managing for the middle in a take-half, leave-half homogenous approach, we're only creating the vegetative conditions for a very narrow suite of these species. So this was a conceptual model that was developed almost 30 years ago by a very smart guy named Fritz Knopp. And thank you, Fritz, for letting me steal your slide for the last 15 years, wherever you are. Okay. So in the past two decades, there's been a significant shift in rangeland science to focus on restoring and maintaining vegetation or habitat heterogeneity, based around, especially in the Great Plains, this idea of pyrrhic herbivory that I talked about before, but now we have a name for it. Pyrrhic herbivory refers to herbivory by large ungulates or herbivores that's driven by fire and that creates a shifting mosaic of fire, grazing, and vegetation structure and composition. This idea was initially formalized into the peer-reviewed literature by a couple of rangeland scientists in the Southern Great Plains named Sam Fuhlendorf and Dave Engel. Okay, so those two fellows with their collaborators developed a management system that they thought would mimic as close as possible based on management scales that we have, based on jurisdictional boundaries and a whole lot of other things, a system that would mimic this historical coupling of fire and grazing, and they called it patch burn grazing. And Sam likes to say that whether he calls it pyrrhic herbivory or patch burn grazing just depends on which grant he's writing. All right, so this is more NSF sounding, right? All right, so the way that this works is at a management unit, say it's a pasture, this area is divided without cross fencing. These are just burn lines. And a patch, a third to a fourth of the management unit, I'm just going to say pasture from now on, is burned. The cattle are stocked at normal stocking rates like you'd apply for this whole pasture, but they spend almost all of their time in the areas that were most recently burned because that's where all the high quality forage is that's easy to access and digest. All right? The next year, another patch is burned, and the cattle or livestock, or actually they've shown this with bison, they've shown it with the pronghorn, they've shown it with a number of ungulates. They select for the most highly nutritious batch, and this rotation over time creates or tries to mimic what historically occurred in this spatial temporal shifting of patch level heterogeneity that occurred in due to the interactions of fire and primarily bison, but also other ungulates as well. Okay, so we have a lot of, I apologize for this, let's not get caught up in the axes, which are unitless here, but this is just an empirical demonstration to show you that this conceptualization of how species disperse across the landscape based on this serial succession, there's a lot of evidence for that, and this is just one case. So in this study, we see that the vegetation communities of these different patches, so this over here are areas that were burned less than a year ago, so this year's burn. This is the patches that were burned between a year and 2 years ago, and these are patches that are burned more 2 years ago. They have different structural compositions, different grassland species composition and community structure, and it's much more diverse and broad than the comparable homogeneous system that we talked about that attempts to manage towards the middle. Now, I mean, just conceptually, when you plot also the Grassenberg community in a similar ordinal space, you'll see that this diversity that's created by this heterogeneous space management corresponds to a much broader community of grass and birds. All right, I'm not going to bore you with all the studies that have tried to evaluate the relative benefits of patchburn grazing or pyrrhic herbivory, but I can say that collectively in the eastern portion of the Great Plains, where most of these studies have occurred, the response is really positive relative to the traditional types of rangeland management system, including research that my research group has done in Kansas and Nebraska. So when I came to Montana 8 years ago, I was pretty fired up about fire. That's a pun. All right, it's not a good one. I apologize. So I was pretty fired up about recoupling fire and grazing and evaluating the effects on northern mixed grass systems, but I soon, of course, hit a headwind. The northern Great Plains, including Montana, is very fire adverse, and this was formalized or demonstrated by a survey conducted of rangeland managers, primarily livestock producers, by Slewinski et al. Some years ago. And overwhelmingly, producers and land managers said, there's nothing that we can't accomplish with livestock grazing that you can accomplish with fire, for good or bad. That's the perception, and that prevents the application of fire at landscape scales in a lot of places. I think that's changing. We have a lot of rangeland scientists out of Fuhlendorf's lab now in Montana, and they're pressing the issue, so that may change soon enough. The reason for this probably is because when you turn on the news in August, what do you see? Right? You see the effects of wildfire in western Montana. In reality, prescribed burns associated with this type of system actually look more like this. Okay, so I started looking around for alternatives, and I came across this this grazing system called rest rotation grazing with deferment that was invented for bunch grass, more arid bunch grass species in the Intermountain West a long, long time ago, but is being applied to a lot of rangelands in eastern Montana. I thought this might be a system that mimics or creates this patch level heterogeneity without the use of fire. So in this system, this again represents a management unit, but now these are fences of some kind rather than fire breaks. And the cattle are stocked in one pasture during the growing season, so from like June through July or August. Then they're moved to another pasture to graze after seed set. And then a third pasture in this system is rested completely, or the pasture is deferred from grazing. And then the next year it rotates around so that one of these, two of these pastures are grazed in a year, one before, one after seed ripe. And then in any given year, only one in 3 years is a pasture grazed during the actual vegetative stage for plants. All right? Contrast that to the season-long traditional type of grazing where cattle are stocked in a pasture for the entire growing season and then removed to put on winter pasture in October. Or a summer rotation system. This is where it's going to get confusing, guys. I apologize. So this rest rotation system incorporates deferment where there's no grazing seasonally. The summer rotation system involves rotating cattle, but the purpose is the opposite of this. The purpose is actually to homogenize the use. So this is within season rotation. So quick rotations within a growing season to reduce the selectivity of cattle. So I set out to compare this system versus this for a whole suite of wildlife species, which I'll show you in a minute. But my expectations was that we might see some sort of signal in patch level heterogeneity that could correspond to benefits to wildlife communities, specifically grass and birds. So we studied this for 4 years out in eastern Montana on a community of grass and wildlife. We were primarily focused on sharp-tailed grass, which are some consider to be an umbrella or indicator species for grass and wildlife in the northern Great Plains, but we also evaluated the effects on the whole community of grassland songbirds and the mesocarnivore community. All right, here's my obligatory method slide. This is all you're going to get. This is all the stats slide you're going to get. This is it. All right. So this is just to show you where the study area was, that we had three separate rest rotation systems that were surrounded by these other grazing management. All these were similar in precipitation and ecological site descriptions and soil type and so on and so forth. There's Megan, the graduate student who led this work. Thank you, Megan. Okay. To cut to the quick here, we, for sharp-tailed grouse, we studied 12 different demographic rates as well as habitat selection and space use and movements, and we could not find a signal in for preference for any one of those grazing systems out there, in contrast to my expectations. This is the result of a most recent study where we built integrated population models to evaluate population viability in each of these three systems. And actually, we saw that there's much higher population growth rates in the season-long system versus the rest rotation system, but these were not statistically different, even though there's a marked signal. But what I can say is that these two systems were much better statistically over the summer rotation system. All right, and I need to point out, and I haven't talked about this yet, but it's critical, and that is that all of these pastures had low to moderate stocking rates. All right, so cattle use stocking was relatively light, and that's pretty common in eastern Montana relative to more intensive production systems in the eastern Great Plains. All right, so that was a bummer. All right, so unlike prairie chickens and tallgrass prairie, where I had studied the effects of this Pyrrhic herbivory or patchburn grazing, we did not find that this heterogeneous, what we considered a heterogeneous-based rangeland management system that didn't include fire in this particular time, it didn't have any real population-level effects on sharp-tailed grouse at least in our study area in the northern mixed grass prairie. So why? What did we do wrong, or why is there this inconsistencies among studies? That really had me hung up for a bit. But then I found this wonderful paper by Marissa Lipsy, it's now Marissa Sather, and Dave Noggle from the University of Montana. They looked collectively at large regions and evaluated how breeding bird densities varied relative to cattle grazing intensity. So you can consider the realization of stocking rate relative to precipitation and how productive those local conditions were, so how good and productive the soils were. And they found that that precipitation and soil productivity completely mediated the effect of livestock grazing on breeding densities of species, and those differed depending on where the birds fell along that selective gradient relative to the cereal stages of grasslands. All right. So, for example, dense grass species like grasshopper sparrows and Baird sparrows, they showed a negative relationship with increasing cattle use when precipitation was low, but when precipitation was high, it was neutral or actually in some cases positive to livestock grazing. And sparse grass species like horned lark, and this is now called thick-billed longspur, they show that under low precipitation conditions, the breeding abundances of sparse grass species were unrelated to cattle grazing, but when precipitation was high, breeding densities were actually improved or increased with increasing cattle use. All right? So that was at like regional scales using breeding bird survey data and gathering cattle use information from like livestock grazing records recorded. I was curious if whether this would show up at a ranch scale. All right, so we set out to evaluate whether those relationships that Lipsy and Noggle found could hold at even a single ranch. So a graduate student named Skylar Vold went out and the same study area that I talked about for sharp-tailed grouse did a bunch of grassland bird surveys across these different treatments that I talked about previously, and then we measured the potentially confounding or covarying effects of vegetation conditions so we could offset our findings based on those, and then measured the site-specific rangeland production potential, so how productive that particular site was. All right, and then we evaluated, similar to Lipsy and Noggle, the relative abundance of breeding bird densities for all of our different representative species relative to this rangeland production potential in the context of which grazing management was being used, and we found that for almost every single bird that we looked at, there were interactions, significant interactions, between livestock grazing system and rangeland production potential. So that has, here's a species where it's really pronounced, that has significant management implications if you think about this figure the way I do. That means that in rangelands that have relatively low reproductive potential, or sorry, low primary productivity or rangeland productive potential, that the best management system for this species there is quite different than when the areas are highly productive. All right? So to stop here and summarize what we found so far, first of all, heterogeneity equals variation equals diversity, and that's a good thing. But one thing that we are coming to realize is that the local conditions, so topoedaphic conditions, soil conditions, precipitation, those things all mediate the effects of livestock grazing and management on habitat and wildlife, and that probably explains a lot of the conflicts that we see in the literature regarding the effects of livestock grazing on grass and associated wildlife. But one thing I didn't show you was that we had a full suite of grass and associated wildlife on all of our grazing management systems there. And overall, working landscapes in Montana are much more intrinsically heterogeneous than the ones that I was working with in Kansas, which are tallgrass prairie systems. And that's because we have a lot more intrinsic variability in soil types and topology and precipitation, which varies. It's crazy how spatially variable precipitation is in eastern Montana. As you move eastern, the Great Plains, the soils become much more consistently productive and consistent, and then also the precipitation is more broadly distributed. Okay, so that was kind of an awakening, but it was hard to translate that to publications in management or in journals because they always want management implications, right? So here's an example from a reviewer when we tried to publish that study from ScholarWorks that said, my main concern is that your manuscript does not offer clear and specific management recommendations relative to livestock grazing. And we're like, that was the point. that reviewer too, right? He's always in your way. All right. What we were able eventually to convince them is that our research is really showing that broad ubiquitous management recommendations across systems for like a management prescription, like rest rotation grazing. Those are pretty limited outside of the conditions that occurred at our particular study site. And it's really hard to gain, without replicating that across space and time, it's really hard to gain ubiquitous management recommendations. So what should we do? How can we develop appropriate management recommendations when we know that ecology is very local? So I came back to this conceptualization by Fritz, showing these niche associations with these serial stages, and that got me thinking about how we can convert these to habitat targets for a species, because as we saw from Lipsy's work and Schuyler's work and a number of other studies, the associations, so the vegetation conditions that these species occur, those niches are kind of consistent across space and time. How you achieve them varies across space and time. All right. So while we set out instead to try to identify habitat targets for species that can be used by local land managers incorporating their own local knowledges of those systems to achieve them, rather than providing prescriptive management recommendations for livestock grazing. And here's an example of that. One thing that I was doing wrong up until, you know, 8 or so years ago, is I wasn't even measuring the right things. Rangeland managers are always coming to me like, we don't know what the hell vor is. Why are you measuring that? What do you think about? And we're like, we think about herbaceous biomass. So we started measuring things that rangeland managers thinking about and then associating those with the suite of grass and birds that we were really interested in. And we were able to identify at regional scales in eastern Montana these herbaceous biomass associations that vary amongst species and consistently with Fritz's conceptual model. And then provide this information for land managers to say, hey, if you have a rangeland system where chestnut collar long spurs are limited and you want to try to improve habitat conditions, we can provide you with the guidelines for the targets that you should meet. And then that's it. You, as a rangeland manager, know how to manage your land to achieve that in some way. All right. So hopefully I've convinced you that ubiquitous guidelines for managing rangelands for wildlife are difficult because of the interspecies variation in ecological niches, and even for a single species, because responses are highly dependent on the local environmental context. That's one issue. Other common problems that I see in the literature or in conservation publications, even for in the primary press, is that grazing is often considered to be just a treatment. Areas were grazed or they weren't grazed. And that's not really meaningful or fair when you're trying to evaluate the effects of a management system on a grassland that evolved with grazing in some form usually. So not all grazing is the same. And we need to be better as scientists and advocates for proper range management that things like stock, we should be measuring things like stocking rates and the timing and the duration and how that translates to utilization and the spatial variability in utilization. Or better yet, we should be measuring those things directly when we're conducting grassland bird research and research on other grassland associated wildlife. All right? We need to know the local context of the condition so we, as someone who's reading your work, can say, oh, well, that was a productive site that was dominated by these species that actually improve when they're grazed, whereas my system is slightly different. All right. Another common problem that I see is that there's this mismatch between what we're measuring as wildlife ecologists and what rangeland managers are actually managing for. And I demonstrated that a little bit. But there's also a difference in the scales at which rangeland management affects wildlife communities that's different than what we've been taught as wildlife ecologists as being the primary ecological components affecting a wildlife population. So we're trained to study like the demographic rates of wildlife species, right? So things like, what's more important? Is it nest survival? Is it chick survival? Is it adult survival, juvenile survival? And once we identify how sensitive rates of population change are to those vital rates, then we start studying how local habitat conditions are associated with those and maybe related to fine-scale vegetation management, all right? That's somewhat disconnected to how rangeland management practices are applied on the landscape. People don't manage for a nest site or the home range of an individual bird. They're managing landscape scales for a variety of sometimes very complicated in-game, all right? So here's an example of that from a recent article we have out in PLOS One, where we, for chestnut-collared longspurs, this is a very important grassland-associated bird for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They're very concerned about the declines in this species, and they funded some research for us to look at, try to evaluate how rangeland management was affecting this species. And we found that none of the vegetation conditions where this species occurs, none of the vegetation conditions or rangeland management practices like stocking rate or the timing affected nest survival of this species, which was thought to be the primary vital rate driving population changes. But what we found is when we stepped back and we looked at the system as a whole, that those rangeland management practices did affect the number of nests, all right? So this paper found that actually it was the abundance of nests as related to rangeland management that was determining like per unit area productivity for this species. Which is different than anybody had published before. So we need to be thinking about using the appropriate measures at the appropriate scale when we're evaluating wildlife habitat relationships in the future. Okay, so first thing we need to do is, of course, curb or reverse the loss of grasslands, shrublands, and other rangelands. They're still being lost, as I mentioned, as a rapid rate from cultivation and woody encroachment, but also invasive plants. I didn't even talk about the problems with encroaching and annual plants that totally change rangeland ecosystems to something else. And this is a major focus of landscape level conservation at both federal and state levels now. You might have heard of Protect the Core, Expand the Core. Instead of focusing in on like one-off conservation projects to restore 30 to 40 acres here or there, focus in on developing systems that maintain the resilience of areas that are already intact and then working your way out. All right. This seems simple to me, but you don't need a lot of data to think that if a system evolved a certain way, if you try to mimic that as much as possible, you're probably going to do better than not. And we need to think more about trying to identify what the historical ecosystem processes and how they interacted with precipitation and local environmental conditions related to habitat at the scales that matter relative to rangeland management. All right. And then finally, empowering local rangeland managers to leverage their extensive knowledge to achieve desired habitat targets or outcomes rather than providing them prescriptions on what they should be doing when, in fact, they probably know that that won't work here to do what you think it will.
You've been listening to Dr. Lance McNew, MSU Associate Professor of Wildlife Habitat Ecology, discussing rangelands management for the Gallatin Valley Friends of the Sciences, recorded at the Museum of the Rockies on November 16th, 2022.